Welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
And so today I wanted to do a quick Bridgerton Netflix update because there's like sort of a little piece of information that has been quote unquote dropped, which is very vague still, but it was like a recent article on shows that are scheduled to come out this fall. And like it was recommended. And also Julia Quinn, she went ahead and like shared that article and said, like, no, I do not have a release date, but I do know post-production is going along very well. So I feel like it might happen in fall.
That would be so exciting because I've watched all the TV shows I'm interested in watching. And so now I'm just waiting for that to come out.
I know. We really could use some great TV, new TV, right, about now. Mm-hmm. I will say, like, we've talked that we are going to be reviewing the Bridgerton series after it comes out. We'll be doing, like, an episode-by-episode recap and discussion. Mm-hmm. But I will say if it does come out this fall, we probably won't be reviewing it until after the new year. Because I haven't told our listeners this yet, but I am very pregnant.
So. Yes, she is, everybody.
Yes, I am. So I am expecting it in early October. So we have been working really hard to create a whole bunch of content for you guys so that we can take a little bit of time off after
AKA Zoe can take a time off because Zoe does like most of the work around here. Aww. So,
well, but I just, you know, we wanted to have fun content and keep the energy going for a while. I take a little bit of time to learn how to parent a living thing.
I know, so, you get to be a mom. It's so exciting.
Yeah, it's really
I'm only so excited, Zoe, because I can't remember when you sent it out, but it wasn't that long ago because you sent a thing out like, so for Zoe's wedding, she had like an email list. So she emailed everyone from the wedding list and was like, hey, BT Dubs, we're having a baby. And I've known forever, guys. I've known for a long time. And so it was very exciting because she finally announced it to everyone. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah, it's just been a weird time to be pregnant, to be honest, just because you're like in your house so much. So like it felt extra like, I don't know, like, it just felt extra weird to all of a sudden like go out on social media or something or like text everyone randomly and say like, oh, hey, by the way, I'm pregnant. I don't know. It just didn't feel right. So when it did feel right, we went for it. So I'm due in early October, like I said. So we've been preparing lots of content for you guys so that we'll have a little bit of a break, but it won't feel like it for all of you, our listeners.
Yes. Yeah. You guys shouldn't know at all.
But what that does mean is that if Bridgerton comes out, we for sure will be watching it, but we will not be talking about it until January, which will be great because then we get to relive it again.
Yes, and that's totally fine. And what I can do is I can live tweet or I can Instagram story tweet. I'll have to just social media, guys. I'll have to just get off my butt and social media.
Oh, goodness. It's a living. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
It's not. It's not a living.
It's not a living. We have full-time jobs on top of this, guys.
Seriously. It's a hobby. So let's talk a little bit about what we're talking about today. So I wanted to give us a little bit of an intro because the book that we're talking about today is kind of taking us into a little bit of a different subgenre of romance or even of historical romance here. Mm-hmm. Because I think that this book classifies as an erotic romance. And we're actually going to be featuring a talk with two erotic romance authors later this year as I'm talking about content we've created for you guys. But I still wanted to go into a little bit of detail here, and maybe not too much, because I'm not that familiar, or I wasn't that familiar with erotic romance before I spoke with those authors. And also, I'm still not that familiar with erotic romance, but I feel like this book falls into that subgenre. So erotic romance shouldn't be confused with erotica or porn. And author Sylvia Day gives us a pretty good explanation of what erotic romance is. She says, quote, Erotic romance novels are stories written about the development of a romantic relationship through sexual interaction. The sex is an inherent part of the story, character growth, and relationship development, and couldn't be removed without damaging the storyline. Happily Ever After is a requirement to be an erotic romance. And of course, you know, erotic romances can contain elements of any other romance subgenre, like historical romance.
Haha.
So the steamy book that we are talking about today is called The Scandalous Diary of Lily Layton by Stacey Reed.
And it is steamy. Okay, guys, but who is Stacey Reed? Because we haven't read a book by her yet. So, USA Today best-selling author Stacey Reed writes sensual historical and paranormal romances and is the published author of over 20 books. Her debut novella, The Duke's Shotgun Wedding, was a 2015 Holt Award of Merit recipient in the romance novella category, and her best-selling Wedded by Scandal series is recommended as top picks at Night Owl Reviews, Fresh Fiction Reviews, and The Romance Reviews. Stacey lives a lot in the world she creates and actively speaks to her characters aloud. She has a warrior way, never give up on dreams. When she's not writing, Stacey spends a copious amount of time binge-watching series like The Walking Dead, Altered Carbon, never heard of it, Rise of the Phoenixes, never heard of it, 10 Miles of Peach Blossom, never heard of it, and playing video games with her love. So I need to do some research on some shows because we were just talking about TV shows that are needed to watch. Anyway,
yes.
She also has a weakness for ice cream. Girl, same. Which is a really big problem right now for me, but we won't get into that. And we'll have it as her main course.
Yeah,
Stacey,
go girl.
Is also an author of color.
Yes, let's talk about our main tropes. So today, I'm going to be giving away a little bit of something by saying our third trope, but I do want to say it because I know some people like to know this trope before they go into a book. So our tropes today are secret identity, class difference, and we do have kind of a miracle baby. It's not a like crazy, unbelievable miracle, but it kind of falls into the miracle baby trope, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yes, and today our main characters are Mrs. Lily Layton and Oliver Simon Carlyle, Marquess Ambrose.
So shall we get into our synopsis?
We shall. Our hero finds himself in a precarious predicament from page one, for he has found himself unable to stop reading a diary he has just found with the most, quote, lavish and shocking, arousing content. The authoress has confessed to some sinful desires in voyeuristic moments, and Oliver is far from appalled. In fact, he's on the hunt for a wife who will share some of his more carnal desires, and he knows that he must discover the identity of the lady from these pages.
And he's in decent luck, for he's at home for a modest house party thrown in his honor, so the guests are limited. His mother has invited eligible women at his request, so he knows that the authoress must be from this group. Perhaps he will find a match after all. The authoress has left a few clues in her writing, the biggest being that she's a widow. That narrows his field considerably. Second, she mentions having knowledge of the secret passages that weave through his house at Belgrave, as she's used them before to watch couples through discreet peepholes. And third, she's intimately acquainted with his mother, for she has been at the last two balls and a garden party the previous month.
Oliver is so intrigued because he really wants to find a wife, but his father, having problems in his own marriage, had firmly told Oliver that he should treat his wife with gentle care and use a mistress for his other desires. Oliver, though, has a very hard time wrestling with that idea because he also watched his mother try to handle his father's many affairs. He wants to be faithful to his wife, so he knows his only viable option is to find a woman who is as adventurous in the bedroom as he is.
So he resolves to spend the remaining days of the house party tracking down the authoress and convincing her to become his wife.
We then get our first interaction between our hero and heroine. Oliver stops in to see his mother and inquire about the daily events, for our heroine isn't actually a house guest, but in fact, his mother's companion. Oliver and Lily have met a few times before, but always very briefly and not frequently, as she hasn't been Lady Ambrose's companion for long. However, each time she's met him, Lily has found herself deeply attracted to him. And Oliver also chided himself for inappropriate thoughts about her, for staff were absolutely off limits to him, which has led him to always act a little frigid in her company. But this time, he notices that she's out of her widow's weeds, and Lily replies that it has been 2 years.
Once Oliver takes his leave, Lily is left to her thoughts while the Marchioness chatters away. Although trying to project a sense of calm, Lily is about to become unraveled, for she has misplaced her diary. She blames her absent-mindedness on the shocking news that Lady Ambrose had delivered earlier that morning. She no longer wanted Lily to be her companion. And not because Lily wasn't a lovely companion, no, but because she had recently found a lover whose company she was enjoying more and more, and because she felt that the young, eligible Lily should marry again.
Lily, however, does not want to marry ever again, and can't tell Lady Ambrose the honest reason why. Her first two marriages had been traumatizing in different ways, with her first husband dying quite young and suddenly, and their marriage bed being unsatisfying, and her second husband, a vicar, shaming her for putting lustful thoughts in his head. Every time after a coupling between them, he had forced them to pray on their knees for many hours. So no, another marriage was not appealing to Lily.
So now she has to contend with losing her employment, figuring out what happens next, evade the suitors that Lady Ambrose was beginning to throw her way, and hope beyond hope that no one, save for Lily herself, stumbled upon her diary.
After spending some time in the afternoon searching to no avail for her diary, Lily tries one more desperate location, the secret passages of Belgrave. Perhaps she dropped it there in the early morning hours. And so she hurries to the library and through the secret door that she knows of and into the tunnels. But quickly she determines that her diary is not there, and while that is a blow, she is enticed by the moaning she hears through the walls. Quote, she closed her eyes, denying the urge to spy on the Earl and his lover. The first time she had heard the sounds, she had opened the small wooden panel, not certain what she would find, for she had never imagined that bedspore elicited such lustful cries. Her shock had been profound when she'd found the Earl's mouth on Lady Wimbledon's snatch. Lily's sensibilities had been distressed, aroused, and she'd been rooted to the spot, unable to pull away from the intimate display.
But Lily's decision to peep or not to peep is taken away from her momentarily, for just then she realizes that someone else is coming. Terrified as how to explain her presence at the peephole, she drops her candle, engulfing the passage in complete blackness, praying the stranger would pass her unnoticed.
But he doesn't. And perhaps he actually answers her true prayers, for this stranger admits he didn't expect to find her here, but here she is. He introduces himself as a kindred spirit, and Lily is confused. His presence and voice in the dark are arousing, but she's also still nervous. She politely declines to tell him her name, and he doesn't press further. She tells him she wants to leave unmolested, and he tells her she is free to leave. Yet, quote, her feet did not move, and she remained pressed against the walls, ignoring the chill of the stone. Who in God's name was in the dark with her, and why was she lingering in his presence? He could ruin her reputation. Though she hadn't consented to remarry, she hadn't fully given up the notion. She sometimes wished for a companion, a friend, a lover, and a happy home. But she wanted it with a man who would not make her feel ashamed of her sensuality and wanton cravings, a man who would not terribly mind that she could not produce issue, if there could ever be such a man.
And then the man in the dark proposes, quote, or you could stay, and we could just be. And Lily does stay, and a few more exchanges of information are made, including that the man believes her to be a widow, for who else would be bold enough to be in the passages? And a lady, and one of Lady Ambrose's guests. Lily does not correct him on this matter, and he tells her he will, quote, not insist on more until you are ready to tell me. And then he admits he found her diary.
Lily is shaken and furious and ashamed, but the man replies, quote, I regret the discomfort I've caused you, but I do not believe I can pro-offer an apology, for without reading your diary, I would have never found you. I had the thought that perhaps there was a woman with whom I could experience the things I've long wanted to do with a lady.
And with that, the air around them changes as Lily loses her shame and gives in to her desires. And there in the darkness, they have a very sensual encounter number one, full of consent and validation, Lily's first orgasm, and quotes like this one. Quote, "There is a voyeur in all of us, from the maiden who wishes a glimpse of a bare-chested man to the gentleman who desires to see the delicate flash of a lady's ankle, the shadow between her succulent cleavage, the flash of curls covering her most intimate parts. We all hunger for a taste of something forbidden. Only some of us have the audacity or courage to act on those needs."
But even after their soul-shattering coupling, Lily isn't ready to reveal herself or learn who her mysterious partner was, so she begs him not to follow her when she leaves, and he acquiesces. Oliver, for his part, is shaken as well. He had been right. The authoress was his perfect match, and while he desperately wanted to find out who she was, he was one step closer, and he knows he will win her trust, and hopefully her heart, if he waits until she is ready.
The next day, Lily is headed to visit her parents in a nearby village for the afternoon, and Lady Ambrose insists that an entirely unsuitable suitor should walk her there. Lily isn't able to get out of it, and so they set off. On their way, they run into Oliver, who, for some reason, is drawn to them and decides to accompany them for the walk. He falls behind them a bit to observe Lily as she firmly takes Mr. Crawford's backwards ideas and insults in hand once he discovers she is reading Northanger Abbey. Oliver finds her set down of the cad quite charming and well done. He also appreciates her refusal of a marriage proposal from the man as well, but does not approve of Mr. Crawford's rude reply and demands the man make an apology before he departs, leaving Oliver and Lily alone. And then, quote, "She was so aware of him. Her skin felt sensitive, and she was striving hard not to show how nervous she was to be alone with him. Is it you? Were you inside my body last night, making me wicked with want?" The words begged to tumble from her lips, but Lily remained silent.
And the two spend the rest of the day together, getting to know each other in the daylight, though neither believes the other is their nighttime lover. On the way home, it begins to rain, and the two are forced to take shelter in a nearby hunting lodge. But both resist the strange pull they feel for each other and make it back eventually without a second encounter.
They do, however, make a bargain that day after they get to know each other. Oliver will finance Lily's dream of her own dress shop if she agrees to help him choose a bride from the house party guests, and if she will sit for him, as he is a painter. Lily would be a fool not to agree to this boon, so she does, even though she protests her qualifications in the bride-choosing department.
The party progresses with Oliver realizing that only one widow has made his mother's recommended brides list. Although there are other widows at the party, just one was deemed suitable. But something about Lady Falconbridge doesn't quite sit right. And in the daylight, Oliver is still inexplicably drawn to Mrs. Layton. At the house party ball, they waltz together to everyone's shock and slight disapproval. During their waltz, Lily mentions that she does not wish to marry again, as she's already been married twice and it hasn't worked out that well for her. They also discuss his marital prospects, and he admits he is intrigued with taking a widow for his wife. Lily again insists that she's a bad candidate for helping him choose a bride, so they bargain that she will sit for two paintings for him instead. As he's already alluded to the fact that his paintings are scandalous, she asks him, quote, "And has anyone ever posed for you in the nude?" There was that dark, inviting desire coiling in his gut again. "A few." Something elusive pooled in her gaze, and she considered him in silence for a few moments. "And if I should ask you to paint me like that, would you take affront or be intrigued?" It was his turn to stumble ever so slightly. Who was this woman he held in his arms? The few women he had painted, they had frolicked in debauchery together, but there was nothing sinful or depraved about the widow of a bloody vicar. Unless...
Later that night, they both find each other in the secret passages. Without much talk, they pull together for a searing kiss in the darkness. And Lily admits, quote, "I have so many questions," she whispered, "so many hungers. My mind has not been quiet, and yet somehow I thought if I encountered you tonight, the uncertainty would be silenced. Instead, it has multiplied."
Oliver tries to get his partner to open up, but she says she doesn't want to talk, only to feel. And so they do that for our encounter number two, which is a lot of exploring new territory and dirty talk of things to try in the future. Things Lily didn't even know were possible, but excite her to try. Oliver is almost overcome with the knowledge that this woman isn't scared or intimidated by the desires he voices.
After the throes of passion, the two begin to talk, but Lily still resists anything too identifying, until Oliver playfully tricks her eye color out of her. But he earnestly admits that he just wishes to know her, because his intentions are honorable and he would like to court her. Lily is incredulous and insists that they are only matched in the sheets, and Oliver insists she explain why she feels that way. And suddenly she realizes that her lover is no longer disguising his voice. She recognizes Oliver, but he admits he has her narrowed down to three of the five widows, but nothing more than that. And so she distracts him by asking her to call her a different name, Dahlia, and seduces him into encounter number three. And she slips away as Oliver slumbers afterwards.
The next day, Oliver finds himself bent over his easel, painting from his heart. When he stops to assess his work, it's a combination of his mystery lover and Mrs. Layton? Was it possible that they were one and the same? And then a diary entry provides the name of one of the authoress's husbands. A quick trip to his mother confirms that the name is the same of Lily's last husband. And now, armed with this knowledge, Oliver isn't quite sure what to do next. He had never suspected his lover wasn't a lady, and this difference of class presents a challenge for him. But he knows he needs Lily.
He finds himself later in the passages, peeping into Lily's room, where she is having a personal encounter for our fourth encounter. Watching her, he knows without a doubt that this sensual lady is his partner from the darkness, and when she screams his name, he is relieved to know that she desires him with the same intensity that he desires her.
Lily cannot stop herself from trying the passages that evening. But when she is about to go behind the secret bookshelf in the library, Oliver enters and gets to business immediately, letting her know that he knows who she is. Quote, "For the last few nights, I've not been able to stop thinking about you, Lily Layton. In the days, you smell like lavender, but in the nights, I can smell honeysuckle wafting from your chamber. You walk in a room, and I am aware of every breath you take. You smile, and suddenly I know the sweetly sensual shape of lips in the dark are yours."
And Lily surrenders, and they have encounter number 5 and 6 together in the library, where they explore new things together, and Lily learns that she does take pleasure from anal sex. Afterward, the two are enraptured with each other, but Oliver admits he cannot marry her, but cannot let this end either. And for her side, Lily truly understands and cannot let him go either. She is almost relieved because she believes he deserves a woman who could be a good marchioness and provide him his heirs, something she failed to do with her previous two marriages. So when he asks her to be his mistress, she doesn't hesitate to say yes, on the condition that once he's married, they will end their relationship. And Oliver agrees. So they go to town and set Lily up in a house and get her dress shop started. Soon Oliver invites her to dinner with his friends. Lily is nervous since they know she is his lover, but he assures her his friends are unconventional and will love her.
The evening is a smashing success and moves into the night, where Oliver gives Lily the chance to display one of her fantasies from the pages of her diary while his friends all watch them in the same room for encounter number 7.
This arrangement, however, does not last long. It's only been 3 weeks or so when, while Lily is visiting her family for the afternoon, Lord Ambrose comes to call. He'd crashed his curricle and it knocked some sense into his head. And in front of her family, he asks for her hand. Lily loves him so, but is so worried and ashamed that she will not be able to provide him a child. However, finally Oliver wears down her resolve and she goes with her heart and says yes.
The two are married and enjoy their honeymoon and marriage and friends. Encounter number 8 is a voyeurism scene where they watch their friends enjoy anal in the library. However, we know that secrets have a way of festering, and Lily's fear of not being able to conceive finally gets between them after 9 months of marriage. Lily tells Oliver that she doesn't think she can conceive, and Oliver is stunned. He hadn't imagined such a scenario. Lily is distraught and tells him that she will support a divorce or annulment.
After Oliver has some time to process the loss of that dream, he tells her, quote, I do not love you because I hoped you would give me children, nor does that define the woman you are. I fell in love with your generosity of spirit, your unmatched sweetness and vigor for life, and your wonderful sensuality. I would be pleased if we were so blessed, and I dare say I would be happy, but not happier than I am with you in my life and heart. I do not feel the pain as keenly as you do, my sweet, but I implore you to give me the chance to grieve with you, to hold you close when it gets unbearable. I want to be with you when you are happy, and I shall certainly be there when you're despondent.
And so, with that gem, our couple is stronger than ever. And then we get encounter number 9 before we get to the epilogue. It's been 8 more months, and Lily is very sick because she is with child. The doctor thinks that with the severity of her symptoms, she is at higher risk to miscarry, so she has to enter her confinement early. But this is a happy ending, and she closes our story with her final diary entry to announce the birth of her twins, Caroline and Alexander.
Aww.
And, yeah, that synopsis did not do justice to the steam, I know, at all.
No, it doesn't. The steam was quite real, guys.
I know. So let's get into talking about that soon. But first, shall we adjourn to the parlor?
Yes, we shall. If you have a book recommendation, we would love to hear from you. If you have an inclusive author you love, we want to hear about it and share it here in the parlor. Or if you have a book you'd like to recommend for an episode, we want to know about that too. Let us know through our email, romancepod@gmail.com.
And you can use that email to contact us about anything. If you have thoughts about this episode or any other episode that you hear, we would love to hear what you think. If you have different opinions or a different perspective or agree or disagree, we want to know about it. So drop us an email anytime you wish to. And of course, you can always find us on social media at Instagram and Twitter at T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, Facebook and Pinterest /TN Strumpets, and YouTube by searching our name.
And if you really want to be in the know, sign up for our email notifications on our website. If you subscribe, you'll be the first to know what we're reading each month. Plus, you'll get all sorts of extras, including exclusive content from each of the authors who join us on the podcast. Our website is romancepod.com, and there you can find episodes, more information about us, and other resources. So take a look.
And finally, if you like what you're hearing, we would love it if you would consider leaving us a review and or telling a friend. Reviews on Apple Podcasts or Facebook or anywhere else you can review us really help other listeners find the podcast. And of course, word of mouth is one of the best ways that podcasts get found. So if you like what you're hearing, we'd love it if you spread the word.
Well, hello there. I'm Sarah Wendell from Smart Podcast Trashy Books, part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Smart Podcast focuses on romance fiction, the nifty folks who read it and write it, and always what books we're reading and want to tell you about. It might be an expensive podcast to listen to, but I promise great recommendations and conversations every week. We have talks about burnout with educators like Amelia and Emily Nagoski. We have gossip sessions with authors like Nalini Singh, and we're always having a good time, and I'd love it if you joined us. New episodes arrive every Friday, and you can find Smart Podcast Trashy Books on your favorite podcast app.
All right, so Kelsey, what did you think of our first erotic romance that we've read on the podcast?
This is probably my first like erotic romance ever, and I really liked it. Like, I thought the story was really good. I liked that it was pretty fast paced. I liked that the characters mm-hmm. weren't idiots, and you know, they kind of went with it. They're like, I like you a lot. They had that brief mistress thing, and then he was like, no, that's silly. That's silly.
Well, and it, I felt like the mistress thing made sense.
It
like
did.
Lily was also worried about, you know, being a noble person. She was like, I don't know how to be a marchioness. And I also think I might not be able to conceive. So, you know, I would rather, but I can't let go of this man in my life.
Yeah. And she also was like, And this is something, you know, about the characters too, which I really liked. And part of the thing was Oliver really liked the fact that she was outspoken and independent. Mm-hmm. He really loved those things about her. And those were things that previous husbands hadn't liked. Like her first husband, they were young. So she wasn't fully herself yet. You know, she hadn't fully come to realize who she was mm-hmm. yet. But she's like, he put me on a pedestal. And then my next husband, the vicar, made me just feel ashamed of being who I was and just was always mm-hmm. condemning me. But now that I'm a widow, I can be me and I can speak my mind and I can be independent. And if I get married, those things can all be taken away from me. And I don't want that.
Yes. And I liked him. Like, he was conditioned to, by his father, to like separate his sexual desires from his wife. Like, that's what his dad had said. Mm-hmm. But then it, obviously, like, his mom had been traumatized, I guess, by something his dad had tried to do with her. And so that's why he did that, supposedly. And then, but then the mom also still was, you know, hurt by his string of mistresses and his affairs and his knowing his sexual proclivities. So it was just like really, it was really difficult. And Oliver could have been one of those really traumatized types, you know, that took that and then was like, no, I'll only have mistresses and I'll never get married, you know, like, yeah. But instead of that trope, we got this guy that was like, no, I'm going to find a wife who I can be really sexual with and we can live both of our lives together. You know, we can have all the dimensions of a relationship.
Yeah. And he was also willing to be like, and if she, you know, if she and I can share, you know, like, 80 or 90% of all the things I want to do, like, I'm okay with that. You know, he was very aware yes. that there were some things that he might want to do that might be out of his wife's comfort zone. And he was okay being like, I guess we won't do that.
Yeah. And he talked about like having a threesome with another man and a woman, you know, at one point, like earlier in his days. And I think he was like, I don't know if a wife would want to do that, you know, yeah. but and the whole like, you know, the voyeurism stuff or the mm-hmm. like other people watching, like those are pretty intense. He those did are... not expect to find a woman.
No. And who wanted and I to loved marry it too, because there was a point where, you know, and when they're like having their encounter in front of all the friends after dinner and she's mm-hmm. like kind of basking in the attention. She's like, oh my God, they want to touch me so bad. He's like, well, we can invite them in. And she's like, no. And he's like, I'm okay with that. You know, like,
there was a lot of consent in this book, but there, like, again, super sexy mm-hmm. consent.
Yeah. And it was because it was a lot of like, and it was a little bit because it would be said as a statement, like, I'm going to do this to you. But then there's the pause. And then like, he doesn't act until she's like, yes. So it wasn't mm-hmm. asking a question. It was kind of stating it like, to be super sexy and to be like, you know, the dominant male. And he's like, we're about to do this. But I'm not touching you like, until you actually say yes to it.
Yeah. It felt like dominance done right, mm-hmm. you know, to me, where it was like both of these people have these desires with each other and they're so comfortable and they're talking the whole time. And so it can just be really sexy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought it was great also. I really liked it. It was interesting because I think it's my first erotic romance too, really reading. Mm-hmm. And like you have to think, like if you took the sex out of this book, you'd have so little development yeah. because so much of their relationship development mm-hmm. was during sex.
Yeah.
Like so that was interesting, but also like it was fabulous. But it fit. It was right for this book.
But I think what I liked about it too was, and it's just like we said, there was so much talking, there was so much consent. And the reason why those encounters really encouraged, you know, the flow of the relationship was because that was when the two could be most themselves. Versus in yep. the other romance novels, it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. Is this right? You know, like there's this like, there's this vulnerability or like the man's like, oh, she's an innocent. I must protect her from all things. But in this one, it's like, okay, I'm doing like, you know, we good. We're checking in. Like, okay, but I need you to go harder now. Like, I want to do this to mm-hmm. you. Oh, okay. I'm okay with that. Like, we can give that a go. You know, it's mm-hmm. very much the discussion. But, you know, because in bed, the two of them could really be themselves.
Yeah. The only thing they couldn't be was their names, right? Yeah. Like they the darkness allowed them to like shed all of their inhibitions, mm-hmm. and yet, you know, hide the one thing that could have made it difficult for both of them. So they got to be like super intimate with each other. And so when they finally did find out who the other one was, it was like, it just, the relationship was so far progressed because they knew so much about each other. Not like they get married, it's a marriage of convenience, and then they slowly find these things out about each other, you know, yeah. or something. So yeah, I thought it was great. Yeah. And I want to talk more about our hero and our heroine. So I guess in general thoughts, we should touch on the miracle baby stuff.
Yes.
Because I know a lot of people don't like this trope. And I know that, for example, a recent Twitter post or thread that I saw by a historical romance author, she said basically like, if I'm reading your book and you say the heroine can't conceive or, you know, has fertility problems, I am going to skip to the epilogue and see if she has a baby. Mm-hmm. And if she has a baby, I'm not going to read your book. Mm. Because – and I think that's totally valid because I think that there's a lot of people who can really be hurt by that, you know, yeah. by that trope. Mm-hmm. Because if you have fertility problems – or just trouble conceiving in general, it can be extremely heartbreaking. So I know that a lot of people don't want to read that, you know. And I was kind of surprised with this book because Oliver comes around and says that incredible speech, right? Of it doesn't matter to me. Like I will. You know, it doesn't yeah. matter to me that you can't – well, it matters to me and I'm sad about it, but that's not what our relationship is. You know, mm-hmm. I believe our relationship is more and I still want you and I want to be there for you and I want this to be something we tackle together, we yes. handle together. I mean, mm-hmm. it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And so like that to me felt like the end. That felt like that's fine. It doesn't matter if she never has a baby. So I was mm-hmm. kind of surprised that she did in the very short epilogue. I will say I am maybe someone who always liked the miracle baby trope, and that's because I was always told growing up since a very young age that I would have difficulty conceiving. And so for me, as someone who hadn't tried yet, reading the miracle baby trope gave me hope, you know? Mm-hmm. Like I always wanted to see this didn't matter if it was miracle baby or not. A happily ever after was a baby because I've always wanted to be a mom. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of it's going to be hard and or you might not be able to have kids was scary to me and real to me. And so I liked seeing it happen, like it visualizing it, you know?
Yeah. And I think in my point of view, in the sense of like, if we're going to live in a fantasy realm anyway, which romance novel is like everything ends in a happily ever after. You know, we live in a fantasy realm in that sense. And if the main characters want kids – like they have the mm-hmm. hardship and they, you know, built the foundation of the fact that that might not be a possibility, but they're still going to be there for each other. But then their happily mm-hmm. ever after does include, you know, a miracle baby in a sense. You know, that's kind of the fantasy giving them the happily ever after they want versus recently I read a book and I loved it because the author didn't give them a miracle baby. But mm-hmm. both parties in that were like, you know, I've gone this long without kids. I'm not even sure if I want them and I don't really particularly care about having them. So like, yeah. you know, I don't think that's in the cards because, you know, and the characters were slightly older and i.e. late 30s, slightly older. And, I know, right? But, you know, and they just said like, I don't think that's in the cards for me. And so, you know, and the author, even in the author's note was like, I didn't give them a baby because not everybody's happily ever after includes a baby.
Absolutely. And even though their wishful happily ever after might include a baby, mm-hmm. sometimes their real happily ever after doesn't get to. And so I think that's why the miracle baby trope can be like hard for people who can't conceive mm-hmm. or who have had a lot of miscarriages, you know, because reading that is, I would imagine, dejecting, right? Yeah. Versus inspiring in that moment. However, I feel like there's, I mean, I don't read a lot of contemporaries. So in contemporary romance, I don't know how the miracle baby trope works because there's fertility treatment in America, you know, in contemporary times. So for me, I feel like historical romance has a little bit more space for the miracle baby because we did not understand what really was necessary for conception, number one. We had a lot more sickness and health and nutrition issues that cause fertility issues, number two. And so when I see a heroine like Francesca too, who kind of has the miracle baby, right, a long time later, we talked about this a little bit in Francesca's book that she – seems to have PCOS, like, or the way that Julia Quinn describes kind of her fertility or her cycles, seems to match up with maybe the definition of polycystic ovarian syndrome, which can mean that you don't cycle regularly, which can make you have less options for or less times that you can conceive and also less, you know, necessarily fertile conditions. It doesn't mean that you can't conceive. It just means that for you to have the, you know, trifecta of everything that you need to conceive, you just need to have a little bit more luck for that, right? Shall we say in historical times.
Yes.
In today's times, there's a lot more, you know, things out there to help with that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like I said, as someone who, I, with this particular character, I thought it was interesting because she, her second marriage, for sure, there was no way she could have conceived. I think that they had, she mentioned that they had sex a handful of times because her vicar husband was like so ashamed of lusting after her. The chances of her conceiving are so low. And then her first husband, again, I don't think that they really had that much sex. But then
they really only had like a couple months together, you know.
Yeah, it was very short, right? So then with this husband, you know, she's only 26, right, at this point in time. And so, like, yes, they're having sex all the time, but sometimes it does take a little bit of time, you know, to conceive for a variety of factors. So I don't think that it was absolutely impossible for this character to conceive. So it didn't, like, kind of upset me, but I was surprised just because there was this beautiful speech that Oliver gave, and I felt like that was a conclusion for these people. And then we get twins, which is like my favorite fantasy, my absolute favorite fantasy. But I was like, wait, why are you giving me twins when I didn't need anything? I was already satisfied.
I was satisfied as well. Like I didn't need the twins at the end. Like I'm happy for them because, you know, she really wanted kids. Like she really wanted them and he wanted them as well. And, you know, and that's why she was so willing to divorce him because she's like, I can't deprive you of having kids. Like, yes, you have an heir to think about. But he'd also talked about avidly wanting kids. And she's like, I can't deprive you of that because I'm the problem. Yeah. And like, you know, she didn't want to transfer her heartbreak onto him, to which he so beautifully was like, I will take on that heartbreak with you because we can support each other in this.
So let's talk more about him.
Yeah, let's talk about Oliver. Oliver is quite fun. Yes. And he is... I just like the way he thinks because at first he's like, oh, my dad and my mom and the having a mistress and marriage, but like it doesn't sit right with me. And then he sees his friend, who's a duke, marry someone and he's like, I know what he likes and he is very satisfied with his wife. So she's definitely open to all those things. And then on the opposite end, you had his friend who was the one having the affair with Lady Wimbledon. And he was like, no, I don't want it. Like, you just have a mistress. That's just what you do. Like, but he also had avidly didn't want to get married. He'd already been like, it's fine. My cousin can inherit. I don't care.
Yeah. And I, like I said before, I felt like he was dominant without being like dominant done right. You know, he was dominant without being, you know, an ass or, you know, a little bit nerve-wracking at times. He was just really sexily dominant. Yeah.
I really wish, sorry, this is just a random thought I had. I really wish we got more of, because he was like, I want to paint you. And I really wish, like, we'd had a bit more of, like, that brought into it. Because, like, I thought that was going to lead to a steamy moment. And, like, the painting, really all it brought him was the realization that Lily and his mystery nighttime lover were the same person. You know?
Yeah.
And I was kind of a bummer because there was this beautiful moment where she's like sleeping in the bed, or he finds her sleeping, and she's like, I had to paint you. She's like, aww. Oh, okay. And I'm just like, oh man, we could have had so much more fun with this painting thing.
We sure could have. But we had lots of fun in this book.
We did.
And yeah. And again, I don't think we've mentioned this, but this book was only 175 pages long. So, I mean, it's, maybe even considered a novella at that length. It goes along at a good clip.
It does.
There are,
but I didn't need it to be more.
I didn't either. So what would you give Oliver?
I'm going to give Oliver, I'm going to give him like a solid 9.
Yeah. I mean, he's great. I don't think that I could need anything more from him. I think he's funny. I think he's sexy. I think he's got some great lines and he's super good with the consent and I love his little speech, you know. So I'm going to give him a 10. I don't think that I could want anything else out of him.
And I mean, like, for me, like, I get that it was part of his fantasies, but for me, like, I sometimes, and like, maybe that's just a general thought in the book too, which is like, sometimes I thought the like dirty talk just got a bit repetitive and it was like, you know, it could be pretty obscene, which like I'm fine with. But I just also felt it was a little repetitive, a little, you know, at some points. And I think that's what knocks it for me, because he's the one like mainly saying it. And so I'm like, okay. Like you said that, you said essentially the same thing like 5 minutes ago. Like there's other adjectives we can use for that.
Well, he really wants to do that. I'm just kidding. Well, yeah, no. And I mean, oh God, you knocked him down a whole point to a 9.
Yeah.
I mean, like, whatever.
Yeah. So it really, really hurt him. But let's talk about Lily.
Let's. She was interesting. I liked the dynamics of her character, right? She starts as this woman who's been kind of oppressed by these marriages, right? And so her new life as a widow, like you said, kind of gives her the opportunity to find who she is and be who she is, at least, you know, on one level. And then her diary kind of, she's exploring her sensuality and sexuality through the pages of her diary and through some voyeurism that she stumbles upon. And that kind of gives her the opportunity to think, well, maybe it's not so crazy that I feel this way or have these thoughts. And then watching her like let herself like let go and try things that make her happy. Every single time that Lily makes a decision, she is 100% in control of the decision. You know, Oliver is always giving her a chance to back out, and it's not like a half chance. It is a very clear no pressure scenario. And Lily always, like, I like the way Stacey Reed did this, because Lily always is like, no, I'm going to take control of my destiny in this moment, you know, and do this thing. So I really liked seeing that with her. And she was also funny and witty and strong.
And I liked that. You know, she talks about how her dad, you know, didn't have sons, but he couldn't do a lot by his daughters, but he could give them a good education. And he really made sure to give them a good education and encourage them. And, you know, it was hard because then she, like, I think her life would have been a lot different had her first husband not died. I think that would have been a big difference. I think what really was the oppression was like being married to that vicar who basically was like, I hate you because I want you. Like, and that's sinful. It's like, okay, dude.
But she's your actual wife.
Yeah.
Like,
but I like how she was really determined. I also like that she wasn't greedy or selfish, because, you know, she could have taken that oppression. And then when she stepped away from it to be strong, she could have become greedy and selfish and wanting to really fight against all that and really break out of her shell. But instead, she still was, you know, generous and kind and like looked out for others and
really was considering of others' wants and needs well above her own wants and needs. And that was just very consistent through the book.
Yes, I agree. I think where I dock her a little bit is the withholding the feelings on, you know, if she's barren or not. She really thinks she's barren, and it kind of gets like a little stressful the way she worries about it and talks to her sister and talks to her sister's husband who's a doctor and kind of goes back and forth and it's like it's fine to me up until the point of when she like when she accepts Oliver's proposal. I'm still fine with it. I'm feeling like, okay, I know that she's going to tell him at some point.
Well, and I think too, she was like, the proposal happened so out of the blue and he just like, you know, I think that she was very swept away. It wasn't like she was like, I'm accepting. And I can't remember if there
she
was
a She tries to deny significantly.
And she's like no. And you know, he really pushes and the reality is she does want to marry him. She's like, I do want to marry you. And
she's madly in love. And, like they're so in love.
Exactly. And so she, you know, and I would say she dings points for me, though, when exactly as you said, though, she's worrying herself like sick and pulling away from Oliver because she's like, if I was going to get pregnant, I would have been pregnant by now. And we should have like, you know, and now I've ruined his entire life. And, you know, and that's.
I mean, and that honestly could be the reason why she didn't get pregnant all that time, because stress and stress about getting pregnant, like,
yeah.
It really can stop you from getting pregnant.
As someone like, who like absolutely physically manifests stress in her body very significantly and like have recently dealt with a lot of health issues that literally just came down, you're physically manifesting stress. Like that's what's wrong with you. That's why you're sick all the time. Like it's you're physically manifesting stress. And I was like, I didn't even know I was stressed.
Right? It's wild what stress can do to us. And so that could have been part of her conception problem with this husband, right? That she was holding this inwardly and then being very stressed and her body was feeling it. So who knows? So I still really liked so many things about her, and that wasn't like the main part of the story, to be honest. It was kind of just came in like at the end. So I give her an 8. I think she's a good character.
Yeah, I'm also going to give her an 8. That's fine, because she was really up there for me. Maybe an 8.5. She's really up there for me.
She's great. I mean, she's great.
And I love too, this is something because she had her dreams. Don't worry, guys. She had her dreams for the dress shop. And even when she became the Marchioness, she didn't give up the dress shop. She still ran it. She just wasn't on the floor. Like, Oliver still did all the designs. This is like, she gave all the designs. She just found good people to do the work for her. So she didn't have the like image of working, because Oliver's like, no, I'm not one of those people that's like, you can't be in trade. Like, go for it. Live your dreams.
Yeah, it was so good. And I will say, you know, just to kind of wrap up the fertility discussion, you know, and the miracle baby thing, like for me, you know, after a lifetime of being told that it was going to be very hard for me to conceive, when it finally came around to that point in my life, it ended up not being the case that actually in this case, it was quite easy. And so you know, any sort of fertility journey that you go on, I think can be really stressful and traumatic in its own way. So being told your whole life that it's going to be difficult and then kind of, you know, having it be easy is probably a very lucky scenario to be in. But I don't know, maybe the books gave me hope. Maybe they didn't. You know, maybe I was just lucky or whatnot. But yeah, fertility is hard and very personal and can be really stressful. So,
and I agree with all those things. And I think that that's something that even just in the last 6 months, I have really, and even, well, actually that like 6 months to a year, I've really, because I had, I knew someone who was struggling with fertility and was having just an awful time of it. And, you know, but she was really open about talking to, like, you know, we would talk about it.
And then mm-hmm. when, you know, and then recently I had my own issues come up, and then it's just like I've found a lot of comfort in talking about it. And I think when yep. you have books that show that you can talk about it with someone and have the comfort there and have someone who's like, I'm going to hold your hand through it, we'll go with it together, I think that's really big, because these are such personal issues. And I understand not wanting to like shout it from the rooftops and tell everyone you meet, but...
Or talk about it on a podcast.
Or talk about it on a podcast. But at the same time, too, I feel like anything when it comes to sexual health, you know, sex lives in general, fertility, I think these are conversations that really need to be more normalized. Like, we read about it. 100%. We read these historical romances where women are so oppressed and these women are like, I'm just supposed to lay there and think of England, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what they were taught. And we're still living in a world where that's very much... Like, you know, obviously it's not that bad, but it's still almost taboo to talk about these things and to talk yep. about, like, you know, your health, reproductive health and things like that. And I think that's so silly. And, you know, some of the things that I've dealt with, it's like, you know, oh, but this is a common issue. Like, a lot of actually in my life of it's like, oh, this is a common issue for a lot of people. And it's like, I didn't even know it was a common issue. Like, you're telling right. me this is a common issue that we can just like fix and you guys know what to do. That's amazing. Because I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's – we need to have more discussions. And I think that it's – I think that as a – you know, part of feminism, right, is this, like, is bringing women's issues out into the open. And this isn't even just sexual health or personal health or fertility or things that are just related to only women. Mm-hmm. I think it's also related to wage equality, mm-hmm. right? Things like, you know, talking about how much you get paid or normalizing some of these things so that there can be more equality mm-hmm. in these spaces. So yeah, but we've gotten really far away from our outline, so perhaps we can reel ourselves back in with a favorite quote. And I'll admit, I put a lot of my favorite quotes into this outline, but I do still have one that is a favorite. Do you have a favorite quote?
I did highlight one, yes, or two. I read this book, and I will say, like, normally I highlight a lot, guys, and I was having a hard time highlighting it because I just was really into reading it.
Well, that's how I was last week with Brazen and the Beast, right? Yeah. I just like was like, oh, it's too good. I just have to keep going.
Yeah, I have literally two highlights.
So then why don't you go first?
So this is, how far into the book is this? Oh, this is after she's told him she's barren and he's absorbing the news and trying to figure it out. But what Oliver's really trying to figure out is how, and I'm just going to read the quote because I'll give it away if I say it in my own words. Okay, so quote, how do I convince the woman I love, more than my title, more than duty and obligation, that she has not failed me? How do I comfort her when her arms will remain empty, her womb hollow, and the one thing she wants more than anything I am unable to grant her?
I'm so glad you chose that quote, because I wanted to include that in his – because that's before he kind of has his big speech.
Yeah.
That I did include. And it's like his whole processing of it is like so – it feels so real and so honest. Mm-hmm. Like he has to grieve for a moment yeah. and grieve the idea of not having children, because he had never thought about that, you know? Yeah. And then he processes it and is like, well, but I can't grieve that and lose the woman I love. No. Like – over this, like, no way.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful. No, it is. It's so beautifully written. It feels very personal, I have to be honest, the writing.
Yeah. Well, and my other highlight was the quote you included. Mm. But specifically, I just love the line of, let me grieve with you. Because yes. he understands that this is something she wants and she can't have it. Like, this is a moment of grief and she needs to mm-hmm. grieve. And he's like, let me help you grieve. Like, and this is, you know, and it's different because, you know, women. You know, I think it's very common, the idea that, like, if you can't get pregnant, like, you failed as a woman, you know. I know that, you know, that's a lot of – they talk about it if women have trouble breastfeeding. It's like they failed as a mother because they couldn't breastfeed their child, you know, which is just like – it's a personal choice. But it just sucks because, like, you know, and that's the mental feeling that people have. And he's like, let me help you with this. Like, let me be yes. there to comfort you when you're feeling this grief. Because as we know, grief comes in waves. It's not like you have one good cry and you're over it. It's – you have life and you live life as normal, and then suddenly you're upset and you're sad and you don't, and like, you know, and it, that's all your thoughts are concentrated on, and this is going to keep happening. And he's like, let me comfort you in those moments.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's why I gave Oliver a 10. So I thought this book also had a lot of humor in it. Like, the characters were really witty. It was witty and humorous. And so my quote is a little bit more of that kind of like sarcastic wit that we got.
There was so much good one of that.
This is when their first meeting in the Dark Passage. This is page 26. Like, they get into it very quickly, guys. So he's like trying to learn who she is. Oliver's trying to learn who this mystery woman is. And she kind of tenses up. So he notices that and he says, I will not insist on more until you're ready to tell me, which she would never be. You are in no position to insist on anything, she says. An untrue statement, for he had all the power in his exchange. He could easily overpower her and drag her into the library. And then he says, I will cajole politely then. There was a hint of provoking amusement. And so, like, in that moment, like, he just kind of diffuses everything. I will cajole politely.
I love the wit and the dialogue in this. And there's so many good little moments of that. These little, like, one-liners. I did like that. I thought that was really funny. I think I giggled aloud at that one. It was just like, I'll cajole politely.
And she's in this moment of tension and he just diffuses it with that one statement, right? Like, and he had such a great way of doing that. So I was super enamored with that. I was just generally enamored because this book was very, very steamy. And I mean, this is our first erotic romance.
Yeah, it was very steamy.
It was very steamy. I mean, I will say there's full chapters of sex scenes. Like, the sex lasts a chapter, but it doesn't. Like, I have read other sex scenes that do not last a chapter that feel a whole lot longer than these chapters. Like, these are like steamy, spicy. Like,
oh, these are moving. But at the same time, too, I thought it was really interesting. And part of the steaminess for me was just how many different elements she pulled into it, you know, the first encounter that turns into like something more passionate. And then it's like the let's try something new together phase. And it's, you know, like, let me, like, was that your first orgasm, you know? And and then it's like, she's like, your friends are in the room with us. And he's like, so what? And she's like, and then he's like, you talked about it in your diary. And she's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I can get into that. That's fine. You know, and it's just like, yeah. Ugh.
She makes it, she writes these scenes in such a fashion that even if one of the things is something you would never in your life do or want to do, it still feels very steamy.
Yes.
You know, like, you still feel like, whoa, like, how, like, erotic or how arousing, right? You know, because she just has a great way with the words and with making you as the reader feel comfortable. I think because the characters maybe have so much consent in these moments that everything is very consensual and understood. Maybe that's why it just comes off as like a comfortable space to read about things that you don't think you ever want to do or would be interested in. And maybe you find out you are interested in it, or maybe you just find out that you have a fun time reading about that. So,
and I think that's totally fair. And I think it's the same thing though. Like, when we read, that first Cat Sebastian book, you know, and we'd never read a male-male romance before, but both in you or I were like, neither one of us is male. This has never been a fantasy of ours, but like, I got into it. Like,
super.
Yeah, I was into it.
Yeah, love is love. So there were 9+ encounters in this one. So that's maybe not our top. I think maybe we had 10 in one other one. But like, again, these encounters went on for full chapters.
Also a short book. I think our 10+ one was, I think our 10 encounter was like a long book.
Was that maybe,
I want to say,
Lordy and Mackenzie?
It must have been. There was a lot of encounters in that one.
Yeah, I loved all those too. Yes. No complaints.
No complaints there. No complaints there.
But yeah, so this was this had a lot of encounters, but honestly, I didn't think it had this many encounters. I was surprised when I was counting as I was doing the synopsis because it was like, oh wait a minute, there's a lot. I thought it was just they were just all long, but they really were a lot.
No, they had good flow because I mean there were times where like you would have encounters in like quick succession.
Yeah,
but they like were very much their own encounter. It wasn't like, you know, where it wasn't kind of like, well, there was an encounter, but there was no break. Like, there was no anything.
There was one that I almost didn't count as two. It's when they were in the library and they have sex and then they play chess and then they have sex again.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, wait, that is two. We have a whole scene of them.
Yeah, there's a whole scene, you know, playing in between chess
and talking. Yeah. So I was like, I'll call that because there's others where they like – have multiple orgasms or there's different types of penetration or, you know, things. So I was like, but anyhow, 9+. You guys, this is steamy. This is a piping hot cup of tea of like really, really good tea that you've never had before, but like you can't wait to try again.
Yeah. I feel ya. That nice hot cup of tea.
Definitely. All right. So feminist recap.
Super feminist. All in.
Yeah. Consent. You know,
consent.
Rising above class differences.
Believing women have opinions and thoughts and feelings. That they're not just empty vessels.
Mm-hmm. That they can have businesses, you know, and why not? Yeah. They can have depth. They can have depth. Yeah.
So.
And her father, Lily's father, had been very supportive, too, of his girls learning languages and being educated. And so, yeah, we definitely saw a lot of feminist sort of themes throughout this book. And I came away from it feeling empowered, which is why I agree it's a supporter.
I would 100% agree with that.
So while this was so fun to talk about this book, we are now at our final rating. So, Kelsey, what would you rate this book?
I'm going to rate this book like a 9.5. Like, it's very good.
I agree. I am at a 9. I think this book is fabulous. I think everybody should read it. The only reason I knock it is what we already talked about, which is like, it felt like I was already satisfied and then it gave me another ending I wasn't expecting, but it didn't feel more satisfactory to me than the other one that I was already committed to.
Agreed.
So like, that's the only reason, but like every other moment of the book, I was just having such a great time. And to be honest, this is my first Stacey read. I just can't wait to like eat these up like
book
candy.
We need to read more of these because these are quite good. Like,
so good.
This is quite good. And I mean, there's more books in this series. I feel like I need to read the book about the Duke.
Uh-huh.
I need to see if the Earl ends up giving up his bachelor life and finding the woman of his dreams.
Oh, for sure. And she has a lot of books. I think I said she has 15 books or something.
I think it was 20.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, lucky me. I guess we know what I'm going to be reading over maternity
there
leave.
There you go. Well, they're short. You can get through a lot.
I know. It was so fun. So I had such a great time reading this book. I'm so glad we chose this. This was a book that was recommended to us through Instagram. We actually got we asked our Instagram followers a while ago like what they would like to see us read. And this was one of those that we got off that list. So thanks, everybody, for participating and letting us know.
Yeah, thanks. And we do actually read your book recommendations. We keep telling you to send them to us, but we really do read them. And so we really do want to know about them.
We really do. We love hearing from you guys. So next time, normally, Kelsey, I ask you what we're reading next time, but we aren't.
We're not reading anything.
Reading a book next time.
There's something different happening.
Yes. So we are going to be sharing with you the first in a series of chats that I got to do with my local library. And because I'm a member of the romance book club there, the librarian, Jessica, reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in helping moderate a series of virtual chats with romance authors with her. So we did this back in May, and we're going to be sharing these chats over the next couple of months with you guys, not like all in a row, so you guys don't just have that format all the time.
No.
But it's really interesting because we've got a whole bunch of different chats with a whole bunch of subsets of authors.
And this first one next week is going to be a chat about contemporary romance, writing romance in today's world for today's reader. And the authors that we chatted with are Kristen Rockway and Lissa K. Adams. And we talked with her like right before, I think it was like the day before she announced that Netflix had picked up the Bromance Book Club to do that as a movie.
The Bromance Book Club. You and I were talking about this. I'm very intrigued. Very intrigued.
Yes. And I've read that book and I really like it. So anyhow, I think you guys will really dig this conversation. It was a fabulous conversation. So thank you for listening and join us next week for a chat with authors Kristen Rockaway and Lissa K. Adams.
And may all your ever afters end happily.
Tea and Strumpets is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts.
Yeah, speaking of ice cream, we may have bought an ice cream maker because it's a pandemic. So, like, why not?
Yeah. I mean, my problem is because, like, I can't have lactose, which is a new development, which is, like, really upsetting, Zoe. The good news is that apparently hard cheeses don't contain enough lactose, so I can still have cheese, which is like, thank God for that.
Thank God. Yeah, that I
says
also
the
have
two
a bunch
girls
of...
where like lived together and would literally make grilled cheese
all
like
the time.
Once a week. Like once a week, both of us would be like, it's grilled cheese night. Separate nights, but like once a week, both of us had a grilled cheese night. Like,
I am also I have a lot of dietary restrictions. I have a whole bunch of food allergies. So like, I completely agree. If all of a sudden I couldn't handle like cheese, I would have so few things that I could eat. Like, my I would God. Be so sad about it.
I know. I was just like, and my, yeah, no, my problem is like everything just upsets my stomach. Because my tummy doesn't like me, guys. And so I have to be really good about it because then apparently my stomach just is like, I hate you, Kelsey. Anyway, this is a very big sidetrack, guys. But we need to talk about our main tropes. We're not here to talk about my stomach issues.
So shall we get into our synopsis?
Yes. Except when I hear the name Ambrose, all I can think about is Hello, Dolly. And
really?
Yeah, because the main artist guy is Ambrose.
Artist guy?
Yeah, Horace's niece is going to marry is something Ambrose or Ambrose something. That's the artist's name. And I literally just put that together now because I was reading it and I was like, Ambrose. I know this name. This name rings a bell. I do not have connotations of English royalty with this name. Where is it from?
I always think of
Hello,
Ambrose
Dolly.
From – isn't he a character – there's another Ambrose who's a character in something we just read. Was it
– oh, maybe.
There's a – Lord Ambrose, he always like gets – it's in Pennyroyal, isn't it? Yeah, because he was rejected by Thomasina.
Oh, is it Ambrose? Oh, you're right.
Is it? I don't remember.
I don't think it's spelled exactly the same, but it's like in our pronunciation, it's the same.
Anyway, guys, sidetrack. But maybe one day we should – we should do a bonus episode with Hello, Dolly, because I love Hello, Dolly so much. Like, so much.